and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a surprise visit by Donald Trump to Mexico City at the invitation of President Peña Nieto, who provided presidential candidate Trump with a generous photo opportunity at which Trump, who had previously labeled Mexicans as rapists and murderers, was effusive in his praise for Mexicans, for whom he claimed he, quote, has a great feeling. They are amazing, beyond reproach, spectacular people. First, the director of the Mexico-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy, Laura Carlson, joins us from Mexico City to describe the widespread loathing of Donald Trump among Mexicans, who are mystified why their president invited such a hateful and divisive figure, who was able to burnish his non-existent foreign policy credentials ahead of a speech tonight in Arizona on immigration, without being challenged by Peña Nieto about building a wall between the two countries that Mexico is expected to pay for. Then we'll examine further the possible reasons why Mexico's president went out of his way to help Trump, who has done nothing but insult his country. Dr. John Mill Ackerman, an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, joins us to discuss the compatibility that Trump and Peña Nieto have in their pro-corporate, pro-business outlook, sharing an elitist contempt for everyone but the rich and powerful, with a complete disregard for the poor and working class. We will look into how the mainstream media in Mexico, in particular Televisa, act as a propaganda organ for the pre-party, and how, in spite of endless talk that reform has taken place in Mexico since the end of 7 decades of one-party rule, little has really changed with the pre now back in power. Then finally, we will speak with Paulo Sotero, the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, who was previously the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper. He joins us to discuss the overwhelming vote in the Brazilian Senate of 61-20 to impeach the former president Dilma Rousseff on flimsy grounds, and the connection that the political crisis in Brazil has to an economy in the depths of an historic recession, which has led to an unemployment rate of 11.6% that has nearly 12 million people out of work, added to which the new government of the extremely unpopular president Michel Temer is now calling for deep cuts in social spending. And joining us now from Mexico City is Laura Carlson, who is the director of the Mexico-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Carlson.
Thank you.
And Donald Trump, of course, met with Mexico's President Peña Nieto today at the Mexican president's invitation, which in itself is somewhat controversial. And it's extraordinary how effusive Donald Trump was. Having called Mexicans rapists and murderers, he just couldn't find enough hyperbole to talk about what wonderful people Mexicans are, spectacular people, beyond reproach. They've made a great contribution, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think it went down in Mexico?
In Mexico, from the beginning, which was yesterday, because it was a surprising announcement, there's been widespread protests. People cannot believe that their president actually invited a candidate, not even a world leader, but just a candidate of another country, to come to Mexico to be treated like a statesman. And after this person had made the centerpiece of his campaign, a number of platforms that were completely anti-Mexico and has made statements that Mexicans are rapists and criminals, that Mexico is not our friend, and these are verbatim quotes, you know. And then the platforms, of course, are building a wall along the entire U.S.-Mexico border to seal it off as if immigrants were a security threat, and to deport 11 million undocumented workers, the vast majority of whom are immigrants, or the vast majority of whom are Mexicans. So there's been a kind of a disbelief here about exactly what was going through President Peña Nieto's mind when he invited Donald Trump to this visit and to this press conference right before he's about to give a major immigration speech in Phoenix, Arizona.
So the conclusion, at least the most logical conclusion, is that Peña Nieto is trying to help Donald Trump. Donald Trump has no credibility as a statesman, and he has no foreign policy expertise. And it would seem to me that inviting a candidate, which you pointed out is pretty odd in itself, to come down there and burnish his foreign policy credentials, particularly on his signature issue, which is Mexico relations, albeit not for the better, but for the worse. So what's your analysis then, Laura Carlson, of why Peña Nieto did this? Why is he in the bag for Donald Trump?
Well, that's what's most bizarre about this, because he has in the past criticized Donald Trump, and he certainly criticized the proposal of the wall, as does virtually everyone in Mexico, of course. And so it's very difficult to find any reason that he would be supporting the candidacy of Donald Trump for the presidency of the United States. And yet everything about this press conference and this visit looked like that. It was a PR stunt for Donald Trump. He was able to come across with a more tempered message at a time when he needs to get at least some part of the Latino vote on board with his candidacy. His candidacy is flagging in the United States. He's under a lot of fire for the kinds of alienating messages that he's given regarding everything Mexico up to now. He was allowed to appear as a much more reasoned individual. He was allowed to, you know, create this hyperbole, as you mentioned before, about now completely flipping and raving about Mexicans themselves. And the only explanation that's come up so far for why Peña Nieto would invite the candidate, the individual who has most grievously insulted Mexico for over a year now, to be an honored guest here in Mexico, is that his own approval rating has gone way down. It's at 23%. He has accusations of plagiarizing his thesis. He's taking more favors from contractors who have won government contracts. He's had a number of problems lately with his image. And he may have been thinking that somehow if he came out as engaging in dialogue, and he said protecting Mexicans by having this exchange with Donald Trump, it could improve his rating. It'll be interesting to see what happens, but I don't see that happening at all. How do you protect Mexicans by engaging in a dialogue that increases the popularity and the foreign policy credentials of the individual who has proposed deporting, some 9 million of them? How do you protect Mexicans when an individual who has been accused of, and there's good reason to back up this accusation, of hate speech against Mexico in the context of the campaign, and in fact, many of his followers have been engaging in incidents that are openly racist. So it's not at all clear what was going through President Peña Nieto's mind at the time, but when you look at this press conference and what happened here, there's no doubt that he has strengthened the hand of what could be Mexico's worst nightmare.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura Carlson, who is in Mexico City, where she is the director of the Mexico-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. And of course, as you mentioned, Peña Nieto himself had spoken out against Trump back in March. He said that Trump's strident rhetoric is how Mussolini got in. That's how Hitler got in. They took advantage of a situation, a problem perhaps, which humanity was going through at the time after an economic crisis. So now, of course, today, Trump concluded his photo opportunity with Mexico's president by saying he was honored by Mr. Peña Nieto's invitation, adding, "I call you a friend." So all is forgiven. Is that right, Laura? Is that all is forgiven?
It would certainly appear so. And Peña Nieto did not even come out against the wall in this press conference. They announced that they did not discuss who would fund the wall. Donald Trump did not change any of his basic positions against Mexico as a result of this conversation, as far as we could see from the comments that were given afterwards. And then Peña Nieto comes out saying that he has this great respect for both the candidates and particularly for Donald Trump. That was just kind of inconceivable for many Mexicans in the sense that they have been putting up with this mockery, these over-the-top anti-Mexico statements. At one point, as a joke, he said, oh, there's a plane, that's probably Mexico, about to attack us. And that was supposed to be funny. When here it is, a binational relationship, and they did stress this, that's very important. It's critical to both nations. Peoples that are tied by family members being on both sides of the border. They're tied through remittances and integrated economies. And while they stressed all those things, there was nothing in terms of any substance that would say that they had in any way resolved the fundamental differences. So all we got was, again, this propaganda in favor of Donald Trump's candidacy.
And, of course, prior to the visit, once it was announced, former President Vicente Fox was quite outspoken in his opposition. He has been outspoken in his opposition to Trump. And he was also very critical of Peña Nieto's invitation to Trump. I mean, a lot of the big networks have always been fairly much in support of the pre-party. I don't know whether that's still the case with Televisa, which used to be essentially the Pravda of the pre-party. But what kind of press is Peña Nieto getting? I mean, this must sort of touch a pretty raw nerve in Mexico.
Yeah, so you mentioned what is the big divide, and that is the divide between the government-allied media, like Televisa and the major commercial media, which has, it's been revealed time and time again, their business alliance with the Mexican government, and then between what happens on the social networks and in the independent media. In the government-allied media, they're saying Peña Nieto invited both candidates, and it was just like somehow we're supposed to think it's a coincidence or something that Trump ended up being the one who came today when it was clearly a move to favor Trump's standing, and that they expressed mutual respect and they're going to continue in the dialogue. And even Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, has said, oh, yeah, they went down to talk about, to negotiate building the wall. Now, building the wall for Mexico is utter and complete disaster, as well as being, you know, one of the biggest symbols of authoritarianism and xenophobia that you could possibly imagine. So it is, again, difficult to understand what Peña Nieto was thinking and the logic, but I can't help but believe that it's going to backfire on him.
Well, the idea that he's invited Hillary Clinton in the middle of a campaign, and of course it's so obvious that this invitation, which was obviously immediately accepted by Trump, and he's able to get this photo opportunity and then return to make a speech tonight on immigration and relations with Mexico, it couldn't be better tailored for him. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton is in the midst of a campaign, and normally presidential campaigns don't go off on foreign trips. It didn't work well for Mitt Romney when he went to Israel in the middle of an election campaign. So I guess, again, one is speculating, but do we know anything in terms of what Peña Nieto, does he have an animus towards Hillary Clinton? Does he not want her to be the next president of the United States?
It would appear that way, but no. I mean, in terms of formal statements, and just pure rational thinking, it would seem the opposite, that for Mexico, it's far better, despite certain real concerns about Hillary Clinton, to have a Clinton presidency than a Trump presidency. In fact, nations all over the world are very concerned about a Trump presidency, and no one should be more concerned than Mexico, which has suffered the brunt of his racism and his xenophobia that have been demonstrated throughout this campaign. So, no, we don't know any of the backstory, if there is one, regarding why he would apparently weigh in such a way as to favor, again, the candidacy of an individual who has done nothing but insult the nation and its people.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Laura Carlson, that Peña Nieto's tanked in the polls. I mean, he's had some fairly obvious kind of scandals, and I guess because the major press down there is so slavishly supporting the PRI party, the PRI, then they're obviously able to create a kind of illusion around him. But, you know, he had the scandal with his... He tried to... I think... Didn't he blame his wife for the fact that a crony had given them a house, an incredibly expensive house in a very posh neighborhood for little to no money, indeed maybe it was a gift. But I recall
He sort of hung his wife out. To come out in the press.
Right. Didn't he hang his wife out to dry?
Well, he didn't exactly accuse her, but she was the one who had to come forward and kind of clean up the whole mess, and which didn't exactly work. But since he was then able to appoint his own investigator, obviously cleared him of wrongdoing. And as often happens in Mexico, where, you know, we're talking about a country where 98% of crimes of any type go unpunished because the justice system is so dysfunctional. And that's, of course, even more so when you're talking about someone with the power and the stature of the presidency. Despite the fact that this was a scandal that was in the papers for quite a while, in the end, he really didn't have to pay a price, except that he has lost in the image department. And it was clear that this move, in some distorted form of thinking, was aimed to improve his image. But again, I think that it will prove to be far more negative than positive.
Well, just the optics are pretty weird, don't you think, Laura, with this sort of large American buffoon who the conservative talk show host in Wisconsin refers to as the Orange Duce, towering over this well-tailored sort of shrunk-down version of a male model?
Exactly. It was, you know, the appearances are not the core part of it in any sense, and yet there's something symbolic about that as well. Peña Nieto looked tense. Trump looked like he was running the show. It was his show, essentially, even though it took place in Mexico. So for a country that is disillusioned to begin with its president, and it is, if it's united on anything at all, it's against Donald Trump at this moment. It was a spectacle that has been extremely disappointing and has caused outrage within the country.
And Trump avoided taking his American press detail with him. Was the local press able to ask any questions, particularly the Mexican press?
No, it was very brief. They allowed, I think, two questions, but there was almost no chance for interaction. And essentially, they just gave their positions that they were opening up this dialogue, which is kind of absurd, because why would Mexico want to open up a dialogue with an individual who's not only offensive, but is not even a governor? You know, he's not even a ruler. He's a candidate. There's no reason to be talking about building a relationship with Donald Trump, because he's not the president of the United States, and in fact, he's trailing in the polls. So there was everything about it was quite bizarre. And we're still trying to figure out why.
Well, I'll join you in that one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bizarre. It's obviously, it's clear that Peña Nieto was tipping the scales and trying to help this guy, and why he would want to do that and what he has in for Hillary Clinton is a total mystery to me. So just in closing, then, do you think that given that the mainstream press in Mexico is so shamelessly in support of the rich and powerful, and particularly the PRI party, you say there's an alternative universe in the social media? I know the people in Mexico have been furious about the disappearance of the students that was never resolved and still remains a massive question. In general, how do you think they can, if there is a majority rejection of Peña Nieto, do they have to wait for the next presidential election?
From here in Mexico, there's been a lot of organizing since families are binational, to mobilize the Latino vote in the United States and make clear the extreme risk and danger that Donald Trump, as president of the United States, would pose not just to Mexican, but clearly to immigrants, both legal and undocumented, in the United States, and to the economies of both the countries. So they are trying to get involved in that sense, talking to family members and people who live in Mexico here who have dual citizenship or have the right to vote in the United States, being trying to get the vote out in that, both here and there. There's some mobilization going on because there's a recognition that this is an unprecedentedly dangerous situation. There's always a lot of interest in the U.S. elections, but that in this case in particular, because he has made these anti-Mexico platforms the center of his campaign since the very beginning, that Mexicans have a lot of, and Mexican Americans have a lot of stake in it. Other than that, we have to just wait and see what happens. But now with this factor that our own president has strengthened the possibilities that this individual could become president and carry out these same policies that would be so very, very harmful to Mexico.
Well, Laura Carlson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Carlson, who's in Mexico City, where she's the director of the Mexico-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with a further examination of the possible reasons why Mexico's president went out of his way to help Trump.
Nos manejan mal. Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre.
Tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar. Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida. México, 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 México.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Mexico City is Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who is an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, where he studies corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mill Ackerman.
Thank you, Ian. A pleasure always to talk with you.
Well, thank you, John. And this trip today by Donald Trump to Mexico City, where he met with President Peña Nieto at President Peña Nieto's invitation, was not reported to either the U.S. Embassy in Mexico or the Mexican government. Nobody was given advanced warnings about this trip. It happened very quickly. It happens, of course, Trump is on his way back to the United States, where he's giving a speech today on immigration and relations with Mexico, which is a much touted speech. So this whole thing looks like an amazing photo opportunity for Donald Trump. So it leaves one asking the simple question, is Peña Nieto in the bag for Donald Trump?
Well, I think that Peña Nieto is obviously pro-Trump. He's never frontally criticized Trump. There's some offhand statements circulating around there in which he somehow compared Trump to Hitler at some point, but that was just an off-the-cuff kind of thing. All of his official positions have been very much pro-Trump. He has never gotten defensive about defending Mexicans in the United States or Mexico as a country. They really share a similar agenda. Trump and Peña Nieto are absolutely pro-corporate. They are not interested in, you know, defending the basic social rights of Mexicans on either side of the border. Peña Nieto himself, since he's been a president, is already today applying Trump's immigration policies. Peña Nieto is expelling, deporting tens of thousands of Central Americans every year, even more so than the United States. And that's a lot, because Barack Obama has already come down in history as the deporter in chief. Well, Peña Nieto is has gone beyond even Obama in terms of expelling Central Americans and deporting Latin Americans from Mexico itself. And so they really have a common corporate agenda of what North America is all about. And that came out today in the press conference. And so to me, it's actually not a surprise that they met in Mexico City, while many others seem to be surprised. But it seemed to be quite logical to me.
But the part that's not logical is that Trump is behind in the polls. And if Hillary Clinton wins, it's hardly going to help Peña Nieto.
Oh, well, why not? I mean, Peña Nieto is ready to serve any boss. That's what he's trying to demonstrate to the world, is that he doesn't care who comes to command him and order Mexico to hand over their oil or their resources, that he is ready to serve. He's ready to serve the boss, whether it be Trump or whether it be Clinton. Hillary Clinton, of course, if she won, would just have to snap her fingers and Peña Nieto would come barking up to the White House. I mean, that's his attitude, and that's what he's showing today with Trump.
So the conventional wisdom here amongst analysts and the press about this trip is that Peña Nieto is trying to burnish his credentials for whatever reason, because I understand that Trump is widely loathed in Mexico. So I can't
yes.
I can't see how that makes any logical sense. But Peña Nieto is clearly in trouble. He's under attack for having plagiarized his law degree thesis. Mm-hmm. The Mexico police commissioner just got sacked. There's a teacher's strike. And, of course, there's the ongoing scandal with the First Lady's home being owned by a government contractor. So is there anything to that?
Yes, of course. Of course, yeah. Well, I think Peña Nieto and Trump are perhaps the two most loathed, despised public figures for Mexicans. And so each of them is sort of trying to desperately use the other to overcome that kind of crisis in legitimacy. Trump, did it successfully by, trying to demonstrate his care for the Mexican people. And obviously a lie is he's a racist and a fascist. We don't like Trump, but he successfully used this press conference. Peña Nieto did not. He demonstrated himself as a servant to the United States and not someone who's particularly cared about the Mexican people. He even went so far as to say that, he and Trump's common interests. He talked about working with Trump and the United States on strengthening borders, both the border between the United States and Mexico and the border between Mexico and Guatemala. It was really kind of beyond belief. If he really thinks it's going to help him somehow by, having meetings with important international figures, he's revealing that he has some serious miscalculations. This is really going to definitely hurt Peña more than he already is in terms of public opinion in Mexico.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who's in Mexico City, where he's an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, where he studies corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. But the kind of, given that Trump had called Mexicans migrants, rapists, and murderers, the Trump on display today was sort of hilariously effusive, talking about Mexicans being amazing and spectacular people,
right.
And then going on to say that I have a great feeling for Mexicans. They're amazing people, beyond reproach, spectacular people with strong values of faith and community. Is anybody going to believe that in Mexico? Because I certainly find it pretty fatuous here in the United States.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. And Peña Nieto, tried to help Trump along, calling them, bad interpretations. And Peña Nieto saying that he was profoundly respectful of Trump's points of view. It was a love fest. They declared themselves friends and shook their hands at the end. Really quite astounding that Peña Nieto is doing this enormous favor to Trump. But this is not actually surprising, once again, to us here in Mexico. This has been his attitude all along. And I think you guys in the United States are now getting a little bit of a taste of how we see Peña Nieto. I mean, this is what, how he operates. He systematically sort of backslaps and supports the most backwards elements of contemporary society, and turns his back on basic issues of social justice and welfare. You know, we have a massacre here a couple months ago of teachers in Oaxaca. Eight community members were killed, and over 100 shot by federal police. And so this is a serious situation we're living here today, and it's sad for both Americans and Mexicans, this alliance between these two dangerous forces, Trump and Peña Nieto.
But how does you explain how this guy became president of Mexico? Is it to do with the fact that you have this kind of insular elite in Mexico that is propped up in large part by the mainstream press, particularly the Televisa network? What is the explanation for somebody like Peña Nieto getting? I mean, even if there's electoral fraud, he still got elected.
Well, that's a big question. I would say that yes, he at least bought his way to the presidency. He overspent by millions and millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. This has been researched and demonstrated by congressional investigations. This money is illegal in Mexico. We have very clear campaign financing limits. So if actually this extra funding was made transparent, that would actually mean that the election was fraudulent and not legitimate, because it went so far beyond the spending limits. And the bigger question is where this money came from. The money most likely came from narco-trafficking or international corporate interests, the people who have benefited the most from the Peña Nieto presidency. And vote buying, which is the money is used for the media, of course, there's a control over the media. 95% of the media is controlled by two companies, especially the television. And it's used for that, but it's also used for just purchasing votes. Voting secrecy is not a reality in Mexico. There's all different ways in which you can use money to purchase votes and force people to vote for one or another party. So I would say Peña Nieto did not actually cleanly, democratically win the 2012 election. Actually, my most recent book is called The Myth of Democratic Transition in Mexico. That's in Spanish. I'm working on one in English on a similar topic, in which really my hypothesis is that this kind of idea that somehow Mexico went through a democratic transition in the year 2000 when Fox won and the pre-left of the PAN came in was really just kind of a myth. It was a big hope, but has come crashing down over the last few years. We continue today with the same old authoritarian system that we've had for the last 80 years in Mexico. And the fact that we have elections, we've always had elections. That doesn't mean that we have democracy. We have censorship. We have assassinations of social movement leaders, jailings, repression constantly in the country, and a real censorship on media. So this is not a democracy. And that's, in many ways, the responsibility of the U.S. government and people in the United States who turn their backs to the Mexican people and think that it's enough just to have a loyal president, a pro-American president, and not actually concerned about what's actually happening on the ground in terms of human rights and democracy.
Well, the previous president, Calderon, did appear to want to at least break the pernicious grip on Mexico that the drug cartels have. And your suggestion that Peña Nieto maybe spent all that money to get elected, some of it was drug money, said he has a new approach to the so-called war on drugs. Does that mean he's basically made a deal with the cartels?
Well, this is a long tradition of cutting deals with the drug cartels. This wouldn't be new. And there is some clear evidence out there. For instance, the journalist Carmen Aristegui, who, by the way, was the most important radio and television anchor, who lost her job because of pressure from Peña Nieto. Now she just has a website. But through that website, she's been doing very important investigative research. So she discovered that at the crucial moment of 2012 campaign, one of the most important financial operators of the Cartel de Juarez funded cars that were being used to fund to pay the electoral operatives of Peña Nieto in 2012. And there's all other sorts of evidence out there which the electoral authorities have not dared to investigate. And yes, Peña Nieto, when he arrives, he announced a change in strategy in terms of trying to reduce the militarization of Mexico. This seemed to be, yes, a kind of an offer to the drug cartels, but in the end, he didn't even do that. He has kept the military on the streets. He has maintained the same decapitation strategy of, you know, knocking out the leading cartel leaders, which has just led to an increase in violence. So there hasn't actually been a great difference with Calderon. Calderon, of course, also cut deals with the narcos. It was a propaganda fantasy, the idea that he was somehow being tough on the narcos. He's the one who allowed the Chapo Guzman to run around loose throughout Mexico and control the whole narco trafficking throughout Mexico. Peña Nieto put El Chapo Guzman in jail, then let him escape, then put him back in. You know, this is just a game, both by Calderon and Peña Nieto. None of them are really interested in cracking down on crime. They're interested in, you know, making a show to the United States in particular in order to be able to justify receiving military aid, but then on the ground trying to administrate the problem in their own interests. And that's a real problem. That's why I say it's the same old system, Ian. We don't have a democracy yet. We don't have a real competitive, accountable public sphere.
And it could get worse with this the bromance between Peña Nieto and Donald Trump.
Yes. Of course. Well, yeah, of course. If Trump comes on, things will get worse. I personally don't have much hope in Hillary Clinton either. I think Hillary will be worse than Obama for Mexico and Latin America. Obama has been terrible beyond specific Cuba advances, but in Mexico and the rest of Latin America, Obama has been terrible. Hillary will be worse. Trump, even worse. We really need to activate on the grassroots level and stop waiting for the higher reaches of politics to somehow change directions and make North America more just. It's really important to build from the bottom up, and I hope we can do that towards the future between Mexico and the United States.
Well, Dr. John Mill Ackerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. A pleasure and an honor as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mill Ackerman, who is in Mexico City, where he's an author as well as a professor at the Institute of Legal Research of the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, where he studies corruption control, elections, transparency, accountability, autonomous institutions, and citizen participation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the overwhelming vote in the Brazilian Senate of 61-20 to impeach the former president, Dilma Rousseff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Previously, he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France International. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paulo Sotero.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Paulo. And it's not been a very good day in Brazil for the former president, Dilma Rousseff. The Senate voted to impeach her. And at the same day, Brazilian officials announced that the worst recession in Brazil's history has deepened in the second quarter, contracting 3.8% after having shrunk 5.4% in the first 3 months of the year. So, and that's the longest recession since the 1930s for Brazil. So I would imagine both factors, there's a connection there, right, between the economy and the impeachment?
Certainly, Ian, there is one strong connection. Actually, the economic performance in the last 12 months in Brazil been dismal. There is a contraction of 4.9% of GDP, unheard of in Brazil. And this is really, in the end, what explains the decision by the Senate to remove the president. Although the case, the legal case, or the violations of budgetary law or fiscal responsibility laws are the sort of the cause, the argument that was used to convince senators, the very number of senators that voted to remove Dilma Rousseff, 61 out of 81 or 76%, tells you that, you know, they were responding to something much more than impeachable causes on more on the technical level. She is seen as a failed president. She is removed, will be replaced, or is in the process of being replaced by her former vice president, Michel Temer, that has an enormous task ahead of him of reviving the Brazilian economy.
And he himself is tainted with scandal. Three of the ministers of his cabinet have been charged with corruption. But the strangest thing is, with that Senate vote of 61 to 20 to impeach Dilma Rousseff, many of her own Workers' Party senators voted to impeach her, one of whom, Ms. Regina Souza, said, you veered from, I'm quoting her, you veered from the narrative when you were elected president of the republic as a woman from the left, a former militant against the dictatorship, without a husband to pose by your side in the photographs. You never fit in the cute little dress designed by the conservative elite of this country. It sounds kind of personal in a way, you know.
Yes, yes, but I think the senator there was not voting, you know, against Dilma. She was making an observation. She never fit the mold, etc., which is true, but Dilma Rousseff was in power, what she has always been, a technocrat with little political experience, with little taste, appetite, or inclination for politics. And in the end, her defense was the fact that she did not commit any crimes. It's true. She is seen as an honest person. She did not commit any crimes of corruption, as many people in Brazilian politics stand now accused of. She did commit, however, crimes against the laws of fiscal responsibility, laws of budgeted laws in Brazil, spending money that she was not authorized to spend by enormous margin, by and then trying to hide that this is the reason. When investigators, when this picture became clear, she tried to do a 180 after she was reelected in 2014 by basically becoming another person. She was not the person that campaigned in order to protect the poor and to keep the social programs. In January of 2015, she announced a new radical program of adjustment, and that's when she really lost support of her side of the electorate and of Brazil in general. She is very unpopular. She will remain unpopular, but in a sort of a compromise, which may yet be very much debated in Brazil, the senators decided to preserve her political rights. This will be a matter of much debate, and Dilma Rousseff, although she has no political chance of any major running for any major position, she will be there. She will be enjoying some perks of having been a former president, and she will continue to say that this, what happened to her, was a coup d'etat, although it was done by the law, under the supervision of the Supreme Court over 6 months.
And again, I'm speaking with Paulo Sotero, who's the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and previously he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de São Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for the BBC Radio Portuguese Language Service and Radio France Internationale. He also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. But as unpopular as Dilma Rousseff has become, so too is her replacement, the interim president, Michel Temer. His popularity is at 14%. So, and as I mentioned, three of his cabinet members have already resigned due to corruption allegations. And he's tainted himself. So it's not as if Brazil is out of the woods. It still seems to be...
Not at all, Ian. You are absolutely correct. The new president has not been charged of anything. He has been mentioned. There are allegations. This has still to go through a process. But he has this enormous task of trying to, first of all, gain confidence of Brazilian and foreign investors, gain the trust of Brazilian electorate, of consumers, and get this economy out of this hole. There are indications, initial indications, that the economy has hit bottom, but the latest figure released today showed that the bottom is very, you know, is very deep, and it's going to be a very, very hard climb. Can he do it? Well, there is no alternative. It's either he is able to convince members of Congress to do certain reforms that are necessary to give confidence to investors that he is competent, that his government can start doing the structural reforms that are necessary to put the Brazilian economy back on a positive track, or he will not be successful, and then the crisis will deepen. And then I would not try to predict what could happen. The idea is that, and this is the hope of the business community, of many in Brazil, and I would say, despite his unpopularity, of the majority of Brazilians, is that the economy comes back to growth. There are some projections released by the central bank this past week, suggesting that the economy could grow 1.7%, as high as 1.7% next year. If that is true, if that is confirmed by reality, we will see Mr. Temer become less unpopular, getting some traction, and gaining legitimacy, which is obviously the big problem here. Brazil continues to be in a deep crisis, although the mood has shifted somehow in the business community in São Paulo and in other major places in the south of the country. This is the choice that has been made, 61 out of 81 senators removing President Dilma Rousseff from office, and the crisis not being resolved.
But essentially what President Michel Temer is proposing is austerity, is he not? I mean, you've got an unemployment rate now of 11.6%, with 12 million people now unemployed, and his economic proposals are basically about limiting government spending, and that's just going to make him more unpopular. Wouldn't that be, I mean, it may make him popular with the business sector, but not with the population, I would think.
Well, that is his challenge, precisely. He faces a situation where you have a nominal public deficit of 10% last year and this year. Historically, the deficit, the public deficit in Brazil has been 2.5%. It went to 6.5% in 2014 due to many maneuvers that Dilma started to do, that happened under Dilma, and this is where the problem starts. And in 2015, after she was reelected, the budget deficit exploded. You cannot tax people in Brazil more than they are already taxed. You have this enormous state structure to support. That's why people are saying that if you cannot tax more, you have to cut expenditure and you have to cut programs. You don't need necessarily to cut social programs. They are not that expensive, by the way, some of the social programs that help the poor. But you have to reform Social Security. You have to address tax laws. You have to make investing in Brazil more attractive by simplifying the bureaucracy, etc., etc. This is his task. You are absolutely correct. The measures are will not be well received. They are highly unpopular. He has no alternative because he has a deficit to cover, and he has to find the money to do that. Hopefully, he will be able to attract investors, both Brazilian and foreign investors. There are many things that need to be done in Brazil. Dilma was not very successful at that, like rebuilding or building the infrastructure of ports, of airports, of roads, of railways, etc. There are plenty of opportunities. State companies certainly will have to at least be partially privatized. Petrobras, that was the victim of this enormous assault by people in the government, by including the party of Mr. Lula and the party of Mr. Temer, is now in a program of shedding some of its assets in order to reduce its indebtedness. There are opportunities to buy assets in Brazil that are very cheap for foreign investors, but they have to have an environment in Brazil where they see a country that is well managed, that is well governed, and where rules are stable, that they can be sure that they will have a good return on their investment. They did not have that under Dilma Rousseff. They lost confidence in Dilma Rousseff. This is part of the problem that in the end made her resort to the gimmicks that got her into trouble and that justified the impeachment, the impeachment causes there. But you are absolutely right. Mr. Temer will have to prove that he is a leader to win some sympathy, some confidence from the people. And the only way possible for him to achieve that is to revive the Brazilian economy.
But it seems, though, Paulo Sotero, that the problems with the Brazilian economy are some big macroeconomic factors that may well beyond control of any political leader. The Petrobras scandal that you mentioned, you know, Petrobras was being handled, and the state-owned oil company was being handled rather like Pemex in Mexico, where it just became a piggy bank for politicians, and a whole bunch of politicians and well-known businessmen have been arrested, and even the former president, Lula da Silva, he got swept up in the scandal. But the real issue, surely, is the fall in global oil prices and the economic slowdown in China, which Brazil depends heavily on demand from China.
I would disagree on Petrobras. The Petrobras was a very well-managed company until the government under President Lula decided to use his powers and his association with other political parties and connections with construction companies in Brazil to create a systemic corruption in Petrobras, stealing $3.5 billion from that company. This was not inevitable. Those were acts that were committed by people in positions of responsibility. Actually, President Dilma Rousseff, for most of that time, was either Minister of Energy and a member of the board of Petrobras or chair of the board of Petrobras. So This was not avoidable. This was very avoidable if people in positions of power had decided not to assault Petrobras. It would have helped the company. Also, it would have helped the company had the government, in this case of President Dilma Rousseff, afraid of higher inflation, not frozen the prices of gasoline in Brazil in order to keep, you know, the impression that inflation was much lower than it actually was. By doing that, she complicated the finances of Petrobras and also compromised the ethanol program in Brazil, which depend to be successful of a higher gasoline price. So there were policy mistakes and there were crimes committed against Petrobras, and this is not inevitable and had nothing to do with the falling prices of oil. Although falling prices of oil had an impact. Brazil is not completely dependent on oil exports. It amounts to a small proportion of our economy. The other things that you mentioned, you know, the situation, the problems seem insurmountable. The problems have been well diagnosed. They are very well known in Brazil. They are debated every day in Brazilian newspapers. It's up to leaders in Brazil, in politics, in the business community, to come together and to decide what to do about this, or to give up, to tell the country we don't know how to fix it. I don't think that they will do that. Somehow a solution will be found, and it may and probably will depend on convincing or on the Brazilian people renewing its political class. Another part that in this whole story is very important, there is a new actor in Brazil, which is this younger generation of judges, of prosecutors, of federal policemen that have exposed this problem of systemic corruption and have been acting very forcefully to reveal the problem and to confront the problem and to send people in jail, new to Brazil, rich people, well-to-do people, traditionally don't go to jail, don't face justice in Brazil. They are now. Will they continue to be supported by the people in Brazil? All indications are that they have enormous support, that they will continue to be supported, and this will be one more element in the affecting the political game. I think Brazilian politicians know that they are on notice about reviving the economy and, second, stop stealing from the people. Very difficult situation indeed, dramatic crisis, but you have to believe that leaders will emerge to face the situation.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Paulo Sotero.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Paulo Sotero, who is the director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and previously he was the Washington correspondent for Estado de Sao Paulo, a leading Brazilian daily newspaper, and has been a regular commentator and analyst for BBC Radio's Portuguese Language Service and the Radio France Internationale. And he also teaches at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm